We're thinking about the subject of happiness over the next 3 weeks, and as we look at this from a sociological perspective, the World Happiness Report, did you know there was such a thing? They're on their 7th iteration. This is presented to the United Nations. The people who edit and write in this, these are pace setters in their field. These are academicians, academics. If you look at happiness scales over the past 40, 45 years, happiness in America has gone down, a decline. Why would that be the case? When we look at kids ages 12 to 17, so this would be junior high and high schoolers, having a major depressive episode. So this is not just general depression. This is a major depressive event. We see that this has gone up. Now, this is only from 2005. That's in a decade span. And this is climbing in all age demographics. Look at the 12 and 13-year-olds. Do you know what you're supposed to be feeling when you're 12? Happy. All the time. That's 12. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to ride your bike and not sure if you should talk to girls or not and hang out with your friends and drink Mountain Dew. Maybe I'm being more autobiographical here, but you get the idea that you're supposed to be happy. This is climbing. 14 and 15 is climbing. And then the nuclear bomb, suicidal ideation, so that is having an idea of suicide, as well as intentional self-injury. This has increased since 2011 on college campuses. This is a sample size over 100 campuses, 400,000 college students, and we've seen just in 5 years an incredible increase, 43% of suicidal ideation, 30% increase of intentional self-harm. And we could roll these stats out all night. I mean, they're there. The data is univocal. It is one voice. It's there. This is an epidemic that is facing people who are in the millennial or the Gen Z era. And we have to ask ourselves the question, you know, what could account for this? What could account for this? Is it the financial crisis? That people are going through financial crises and they feel depressed or anxious or suicidal. The kids? No, that's not what the scholars say. In fact, many of the scholars will say that it's actually the upper class that has worse mental health than the middle class or even the lower class. The more money the kids have in the family, the worse off they are. That's not it. Is it that today, in 2019, we have less access to therapy or a therapist? That can't be true compared to the 70s, when that was kind of mocked. If you had to go see a therapist or something, that was kind of, you're put down, you're a sissy. Today, it's very open, and there's therapists everywhere. We've got access to this. That can't be the issue. What about pharmacology, the study of pharmaceuticals, medicine, medication? Maybe that's just not that good. See, this has only gotten better with time. You talk to doctors and they say, oh yeah, we used to give these meds out back in, you know, the Stone Ages. We didn't even know we were giving out. Today, way better medication, way more stable. That can't be the issue. What if it's stigmatizing mood disorders? You know, people who have anxiety, depression, maybe it's that we stigmatize those people and we look at them and we say, man, yeah, that person's a nutcase. They're crazy. They're nuts. I mean, I think that happens. I hate to hear that when it does. But are we really to believe that it's worse today than it was in the 70s or the 50s? Give me a break. I mean, today we are way more sensitive to this than ever before. So it isn't money. It isn't therapy. It isn't drugs. It isn't the culture. What is it? Let's think back about 100 years to a race that is called the Tour de France, or if you prefer, the Tour de France. In the early 1900s, it was believed by these athletes, these world-class cyclists, that as you cycled and as you went on this, you know, multi-day race, an anaerobic exercise from hell, it was thought that if you drank wine, now isn't this just so French? You know, the only thing he's missing is cheese. You know, he's just drinking wine. And look, everyone else just thinks it's completely normal. He's chugging wine on his bike. On the final race, as they would come across the finish line, they would smoke filterless cigarettes. They thought that this opened up their lungs. Here's one guy like, no, I really want to help you win the race, so I'm going to take my cigarette to light yours. And look at everyone. It's just like plain as day. This just makes complete sense. Is it possible that we, as a culture today, 100 years later, have bought into some culturally accepted norms about mental health, just like they bought into some culturally accepted norms about physical health? Could it be that in 100 years, people will look back at us and say, oh, they were cavemen, the way that they were living. How could they do that to themselves? Just like we would look at this picture here and say, how could you be a professional athlete smoking and drinking during the, like some athletes do that after, okay? But during the actual activity, you thought that was a good idea. Well, that's what we're going to argue here tonight. That there are three myths when it comes to mental health that people have bought into, that these are out of step with reality. They're not real. Think to yourself, when you get depressed, you get anxious, what is the first thing that you reach for? For many people, it's a phone. You know, they have their phone on them at all times. They feel kind of naked. They feel kind of insecure without it. And when they feel like they need to get away or escape, hit the escape hatch on their depression, they reach for their phone. It's so common. Is it good? That's the question. It's common. This is normal, but is it good for us? A study from this year on depression compared those who don't use social media at all versus those who use it 5 hours or more per day. They found that the group that used it 5 hours or more per day were 3 times higher to be depressed. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're like, okay, so that's not me. I don't use social media 5 hours a day. I'm also not some kind of, what are we, Amish here, where we don't use it at all? Is that what you're expecting here? Jean Twenge, 2018, last year, she compared those with heavy internet use with those with light internet use. So this would be a more moderate test. She found that those with the heavy internet use were 2 times more depressed than those with the light internet use. And this has been cycled through. 1,000 adults, 2016, quit Facebook for a week and reported more happiness, less depression. The same results occurred for simply limiting social media usage. And that's something to think about for a second. Something which we think is so normal, so obvious, that of course that's something that would be good for your health. And really, this could be equivalent to smoking and drinking on the cycling tour. Why is it? Why would there be some kind of a connection? You might say, well, that's correlation, not causation. Is there a causative or a causal effect between the two? I suspect so, yes. For one, social media usage, it encourages a lack of sleep. I remember talking to a guy one time, and he said, man, I've been so tired, you know, so tired, always tired all the time. So I said, what time are you getting to bed? He said, well, midnight. What time are you getting up? 8 o'clock. I was like, every night? He's like, yeah. What's the problem? I don't know, man. Maybe it's a low iron deficiency, or, you know, maybe it's a thyroid thing, or I don't know what it is. And one of his buddies was like, dude, you get to bed at midnight. You don't fall asleep until 2. I'm like, what's that about? He's sitting there with his phone. So in his mind, he's thinking, I get 8 hours of sleep. In reality, it's only 6. Got to keep up on all those great, really deep YouTube videos. And he's missing sleep. And sleep, as we can see, is connected right across the board with mental health, physical health, and really everything else. There's less social interaction. And I mean in the sense of like a substantive social interaction, where just, you know, liking someone's tweet or, you know, responding to someone's poke or whatever it is, that's not really, you know, responding in a way that's substantive, like a real social interaction. You know, to actually sit there and be able to talk to people and to look them in the eyes when you're talking, that is crazy. Give me a second. L-O-L. Okay, that's good. Sorry. Anyways, to talk people and to look them in the eye and to be able to, yeah, to be able to, you know, actually have like a conversation with the person, and everyone's like, this is so awkward. That's how I feel around you when you pull out your phone and you're just like, I'm like pouring my heart out and you're like, oh, well, on your phone, taking a selfie. Isn't that strange? Isn't that just totally bizarre? What were you thinking when you saw me doing that? Does he not know that there's 400 people in this room? Doesn't he care? Doesn't he love us? Doesn't he respect our time? He can't put that off for a little bit. Well, the same thing is true here. You know, we get to a point where we realize we're done with work, we're done with school, and now it's our time to really look each other in the eye and to relate and to bond and to bear each other's burdens and to love each other. And this is not an uncommon picture. It's finally time to talk, and we're sitting there looking at the phone. There was a whole national media stir with this sorority that went to a baseball game, and the whole time they kept showing them just taking selfies. The entire, they didn't even see the game. They knew nothing about the game. Everyone was criticizing them. I'm like, that's you. That's me. That's everybody. They're so harsh on these girls. You go out to eat and you see families sitting there together. This is the place where we're supposed to have, you know, love, security, relationship, closeness. And even dad, even mom, they're on their phone. We can't connect with each other. All right, here's a little video. Check this out.
Without NFL.com fantasy football, what would friends talk about?
So, how's your cat? Cat's doing well. How about your cat? I don't have a cat.
NFL.com fantasy football. It's fun, it's free, it's easy.
What's the message behind that commercial? What do men talk about? To sit down, cats apparently. To sit down as a man with another man and to really talk and to really know each other and to have a friendship, that's just too weird. What isn't weird? What's not weird? Well, to sit there and talk about a football game and comparing our final fantasy. It's a fantasy world. There's also what are called upward social comparisons. When you look at these pictures here, these are just kind of staple Facebook, Instagram kind of pictures. You look at these pictures and you're just flipping through them one after another, and you ask yourself, how do I compare? You know, 100 years ago, you lived in a town, small town. There were hardly any cars. There was probably 3-4 attractive people in your town. As a married man, you're out, you know, you're walking behind a mule or something, and looking at the back end of a mule all day, and then you go home and you see your wife and you're like, you look gorgeous, honey, you know? And today we don't have that issue. We are making thousands, literally thousands of judgment calls. Comparing myself to other people, some people I don't even know. Some people I don't even know if they're real, if it's been airbrushed. How do I compare physically? Why don't I look like him? How do I compare emotionally? I'm kind of a depressive kind of guy, and I look around at these other people, they look happy all the time. It just seems like they're always happy. How do I compare financially to them? I don't make as much money. And I look at their pictures, and it's like every picture is they're holding, you know, a stiff drink, and their toes are in the sand, they're on another vacation. How do I compare relationally? You start to get older, and all of a sudden you start to notice, my friends are getting married, why am I not married? They're having kids. Why do I not have kids? Why do they have all these friendships? Why are they doing all these things? And we're making these upward social comparisons all the time. Here's why it's a myth. We're comparing the reality of our lives with the best filtered version of everyone else's life. And so this isn't a fair comparison. We're getting these little snapshots of other people's lives which aren't real. They are false. They're phony. And we're presenting a little, you know, avatar of ourselves out there as well to make people think that we're something that we're not. It's disingenuous. It isn't real. And even for those people who are in the upper echelon of the good looking and the attractive, for example, supermodels, very depressed. Very depressed. Meyer et al. From 2007. They say models compared to others were slightly more suspicious, non-conforming, intensely emotional, interpersonally alienated, eccentric, and self-centered. Wow. So these are the people we're looking at on the fitness magazines, on the images. We want to look like them. I want my stomach to look like his. And then when we realize behind the scenes, they're more screwed up than I am. They have just the same problems I do. And this doesn't go away. To be fair, studies do show that good-looking people are treated better and thought to be more competent, which I'm suspicious of because I've never been treated better or more competent in my life. Or that could mean... Anyways... You're like, you're what we call average, okay? And be happy with that designation. There's also physical effects on the brain from digital media. Here's a little clip. This from 2017. This is from Sean Parker. You know who Sean Parker is? If you've seen the movie The Social Network about Facebook, Sean Parker is played by Justin Timberlake in that movie. He is the first founding president of Facebook. I know Zuckerberg invented it. He was the first president. Check this out.
You know, if the thought process that went into building these applications, Facebook being the first of them to really understand it, that thought process was all about how do we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible. And that means that we need to sort of give you a little dopamine hit every once in a while because someone liked or commented on a photo or a post or whatever. And that's going to get you to contribute more content, and that's going to get you, you know, more likes and comments. I mean, it's a social validation feedback loop it's exactly the kind of thing that a hacker like myself would come up with because you're exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology.
That's an interesting way of putting it. Yeah. Since then, he's dumped all of his money into charity. Since then, yeah. Well, as we study the hard sciences, we've been looking at the social sciences. As we study the hard sciences, we see that digital media, phones, mobile phone dependence, MPD, internet addiction disorder, IAD, these have neurological effects on the brain. For one, they've studied that there is an atrophy, you know what atrophy is, where, you know, you get a cast on your leg and your muscles weaken. So an atrophy of the gray matter in your brain. The gray matter is on the cortex of your brain. The cortex is the outside of the brain. And this is where all the synapses are firing in the brain. So there's an atrophy of this. Then there's a loss of white matter integrity. White matter is, you could think of it like the conduits. They're myelinated. It's basically, myelin is like a grease, brain grease that, you know, greases the skids that gets, you know, information from one part of the brain to the other. And they see in people with, you know, screen dependency and internet addiction disorder, that these people have spotty white matter. They have impaired cognition, impaired thinking. They have reduced dopamine receptors. Wow. They're trying to put this into the DSM, which is the standard text for mental disorders. They're trying to move because they put in gambling, and they said gambling isn't a substance addiction. And yet when you're a gambler, when you win a hand, all you're thinking about is, you know, that boost of dopamine and excitement and cortisol and adrenaline, and you can't wait to get the next round of hands to bet again. And the same thing is true with internet addiction. It's we're constantly looking for the next video, for the next thing, the next like, the next... And it basically fries out our brain. Maybe you were looking at those Frenchmen with their cigarettes and their drink, and you're saying, oh, man, those guys are fools. Don't they know that's going to cause cancer to their lungs? This is saying it's not going to affect your lungs, it's going to affect your brain. How about that? Who's the fool? Here's an fMRI, a functional magnetic resonance image of a normal group, people that weren't addicted to the screen dependency. And as you see on the right-hand side, that's our key. If you're in the red, that's very low. And if you move up to orange, yellow, white, that's, you know, tons of electrical activity. And they exposed them to a stimulus. They exposed the normal group to a stimulus to see how it would affect their brain. Then they exposed the internet dependency group to the same stimulus. Brains were lit up like firecrackers. And look what we see here. Tons of yellow. I mean, this is incredible. And it's the same thing. They're looking at the same thing. You're like, so who cares? This is the same phenomenon that you see with drug addicts. That if, you know, somebody who's never done cocaine, they do cocaine, their brain lights up a certain way. A drug addict, their brain will light up a totally different way. What about gray matter on the brain? The x-axis, the horizontal, those are the number of months that the person is addicted to digital media. The y-axis, that's the vertical, that's the gray matter integrity, the synapses. So very high, that'd be good. Low would be really bad. Now look at this. Right at about 2 years, 24 months, we see a precipitous decline. Only until you hit about 48 months, and then there's a crash. Isn't this true? Isn't this intuitive? Then when you're sitting there, and I'm not even going to show the video game studies out there. I got plenty of those. I had to cut back. But isn't it true that when you're sitting there, you know, looking through page after page and video after video, and then you try and talk to somebody, you feel that zombified, disenchanted. It's hard to connect. It's hard to talk. Well, what are we saying here? Are we saying that everyone should get off of digital media? No one's ever said that. I have had friends who have deleted their accounts and stuff. I will say, those people I've talked to, they've said, I'm not missing anything. I'm like, so what are you doing with their time now? And they're like, I don't know, like going for a walk, talking to people, you know, reading a book, doing a hobby. I'm like, dude, you're missing out on like thousands of videos. Don't you realize that? They don't feel like they're missing out on anything. Here's the thought. Could we have some moderation here? Like, are we so far into this we can't even realize it? The key here is not that we want to look away from digital media. It's that we want to see through it, to be able to realize this is inauthentic, this is phony, this is fake, this isn't real, that it's boring, that when I sit there for hour after hour on the phone, on the screen, that I'm in a subhuman state, that I'm looking at this screen like a zombie, and it's boring. There's nothing exciting about it. It's just a little spike of dopamine and then right back to normal. And I'm basically like a lab rat. That's all it is. And there's no lasting happiness here. None. You know, at the end of your life, you're not going to be thinking to yourself, man, I really wish I would have watched more cat videos. Man, I really missed out. No, this really isn't that exciting. And this could be kind of like the proverbial frog in the boiling water. It could be that we're just cooking in a generation of people to think that this is normal. Well, number two, the myth of romantic love. And you're like, so you're against love? Is that what you're saying? No. I'm against romantic love. This is a very Western, modern picture. I know this movie is a quarter century old, but Jerry Maguire, where Tom Cruise says, "You complete me." That's my best Tom Cruise impression, by the way. And the other girl's like, "You had me at hello." You know, and "you complete me." It's basically, what's that saying? I'm an incomplete person, and I'm looking around in the world, half of a body, looking for someone to complete me. Ugh, barf. So, completely, what do you call that? Hyper dependency on somebody else. We're soulmates. This whole idea that I'm just wandering through the world with some kind of a love radar, hoping to find. Yeah, we're in love. And I found you finally. Now we're complete. You'll meet the one, the one, the one. This isn't the Matrix here, okay? Neo. Love at first sight. I don't believe in that. I don't believe that's what love is. Happily ever after. I don't believe in that either. You know, you watch these romantic films where, you know, it's the guy and the girl, and they love each other, and they fight, and they're trying to get through, and there's conflict and obstacles, and the families hate each other, and there's differences, and then finally, they push past the conflict, and they reach the climax, and they embrace, and they kiss, and next scene, they're at the altar, and it's, "Do you take her? I do. Do you take him? I do." And they kiss, and then, you know, the screen goes dark, and Coldplay plays, you know, and the credits roll, and it says, you know, directed by Nicholas Sparks, or whatever, and you're like, oh, man, oh, what a good movie, you know. And for those of us who are married, we're like, that's not the end of the movie. That's the beginning of the movie. You think you went through conflict before. Oh, just you wait, pal. It's you're going to be a changed person. In fact, scientists tell us that high expectations hurt marriages. That you're completing me. That you're my other half. That I could do nothing without you. You're the one. That these kind of expectations hurt love, hurt happiness. Viewing love as perfect unity hurts relationship satisfaction. Yeah, the idea that I'm here to suck off you, love feelings and security. You guys are gross, man. Security, where was I? All right, affairs. Let's move on to affairs. Affairs fade in 6 months. Anyone who says, you know, well, sex, you're going to be real depressed, and, you know, go out for sex, you'll be real depressed, they're lying. Sex is incredible, very awesome. The point is that going for a sexual affair, a sexual escapade, this fades real fast. So going out on your spouse, for example, you think that person really understands you and really understands me, and then all of a sudden, within 6 months, you're staring at the same person you're married to. Because there's a problem. There's a problem with that person is you're dating them. You brought your problems with you. And so this completely has a decline, and the feelings are gone. They go away. Interestingly, Proverbs 31:30, it says, charm is deceptive and beauty does not last, but a woman who fears God will be greatly praised. How's that for a high view of woman? Right there. You're not just an object, a bunch of shapes. I value you for you as a person. I love you. Not how you make me feel, not how you flirt and it makes me feel, or how you look. If you base your happiness, your marriage, on looks, on feelings, on charm, stuff like that, that's going to fade. And then 10, 20, 30, 40 years later, you're going to wake up in bed and you're going to look over at this person. You don't love them. And they're ugly. Then what are you going to do? Brian D. Earp, out of the University of Oxford, he says the past decade has seen a dramatic increase in published studies on the neurobiology and neurochemistry of romantic love. Taken together, these studies suggest that the subjective state or states of, quote, being in love is intimately tied to characteristic biochemical reactions occurring within the brain. Now, stick with me here. He says these reactions involve such compounds as dopamine, oxytocin, vasopressin, serotonin, and recruit brain regions known to play a role in the development of trust, pleasure, and reward. Okay, we all have felt that before. No surprise there. Then he says the involvement of similar neurochemicals and neural activities in processes associated with addiction has already been well established. That whole idea that when you fall in love, you just can't help yourself. It's like you're thinking about the person. You're agitated when you're not around them. You wonder how you're making them feel and so forth. These are the same pathways, the same chemicals for drug use. Scientists have drawn parallels between the naturally rewarding phenomena associated with human love and the artificial stimulation afforded by the use of addictive substances such as alcohol, heroin, or cocaine. Even quote-unquote normal romantic passions are chemically and behaviorally analogous to addiction. That's so wild. Here's Burkett and Young from Emory University. They say virtually every neurochemical system implicated in addiction also participates in social attachment processes. In a very real sense, we may be addicted to the ones we love. Well, that's a little bit pessimistic. I think what they mean here is in the opening stages of romance, you feel that overwhelming closeness and romantic rush that you can't help it. But over time, the point is that's going to fade. And so when you're thinking to yourself, you know, I'm depressed. I'm anxious. I'm lonely. I'm not happy with my life. What do I need? I need somebody. I need to go out there and find an affair. I need to go out there and find a woman, man, whatever. In these situations, you need to realize with a little bit of foresight, yes, that will bring temporary happiness, but it's the same kind of happiness that a drug addict would have. Exactly the same. The same neurological pathways, the same neurochemical attachments that they have. It's the same precise thing. So what are we saying here? Are we saying that romance and romantic feelings are wrong? No. I look back on my time with my wife, and there's still times of romance in your marriage, and you really love that. But I remember before I got married, my friend, who's older than me by 4 months, very wise older man, I was talking to him, I was asking him questions about marriage and stuff, and he said, you know, as I look at my marriage, he said, the thing that makes me happiest, I thought would be the sex. He says, actually, the thing that makes me happiness is the relationship. Just to be happy, to love that person. And yeah, there's times of romance, and those are great, and you love those, but that's not the basis of what brings you happiness. The romantic feelings, these don't last long. They damage relationships long term. We're basically buying into a cultural script that isn't going to work. And it doesn't bring lasting happiness to your life. So this idea that I'm just going to jump from person to person, relationship to relationship, that is not going to bring, that's a myth. That is just the same as drinking the wine and smoking the cigarettes on the bike. This is a cultural, very Western myth that you're buying into. But there's a little bit of truth in it. There's a little bit of truth in the sense because in the Christian view, we hunger to be loved. You know, that feeling of when you meet a significant other and that person really looks at you and desires you, wants you, that you can be safe around that person. I don't know if you've had that experience where you can just say anything you want and they get you, they accept you, they love you, they sacrifice for you. This is a picture, according to Ephesians 5:32, which points toward God's love for us. That God looks at us, not in any weird sexual way, but in a loving way. He looks at us and he says, I love you. I accept you for who you are. It isn't that we have too high a view of love. It's that we're settling for too low of a view. Well, myth number three, finally, is the myth of materialism. That I'm going to be a real big, important person, and then all of a sudden people are going to like me. Not true. Study done in 2008 at the University of Rochester. They studied 147 college graduates right from when they graduated, and they picked up with them a year later. And they compared their psychological states a year later, and they also compared their goals. On the one hand, they had a group that had what are called extrinsic goals. These are goals like money, fame, having a good appealing image, extrinsic out there. Then there were another group that had intrinsic goals, goals that were like, what do you want to do with your life? I want close relationships. I want community. I want to be a better person. I want to love more than I did last year. Those kind of people. You met those kind of people before? Yeah. You met the first kind before? Yeah. How did this all pan out here? When it came to well-being, the extrinsic goal, statistically insignificant, didn't help their life hardly at all. Intrinsic aspirations like relationships, community, and personal growth shot right through the roof. These were the people, 1 year later, who were incredibly happy with their lives. By contrast, when it came to ill-being, depression, anxiety, all that, loneliness, intrinsic aspirations like relationships and love and community protected people from anxiety and depression. One thing you're going to hear me say throughout this series over and over, because it comes up in the literature over and over and over again, is the number one predictor of human happiness is having good social relationships. Let me repeat that. The number one predictor of happiness is having good social relationships. You read any scientist across the board, they're going to put that at number one. And it shouldn't surprise us whatsoever. Kahneman and Deaton out of Princeton University, they surveyed 500,000 people, and they found that emotional well-being also rises with log income. But there is no further progress beyond an annual income of $75,000. They say once you reach 75K, that's it. Happiness in relation to money, no correlation. None. And so it caps out. Now, if you're making $7,500 a year, yeah, you would definitely feel a lot happier making $75,000. But once you get to $75,000, that's it. You cap out. There we go again. The Proverbs, the wisdom literature of the Bible, chapter 30, verse 8. It says, give me neither poverty nor riches. There you go. We don't want to live an impoverished life. That wouldn't be healthy. We don't want to live a rich life either. Why? He says, give me just enough to satisfy my needs. That's why. That's all I need. I need a roof over my head. I need my needs met. And then anything beyond that, I just would want to give it away. Well, I better bite my tongue because we're going to talk about that next week. We look at celebrities. We definitely see that this is the case. Justin Bieber says, I get depressed all the time. I feel isolated. I wouldn't wish this upon anyone. Lady Gaga, famous, so alienating. Tom Brady, why do I still think there's something greater out there for me? Russell Brand, it doesn't fill your soul. I still feel empty inside. Beyonce, I would be very happy if I could just cut it off, just enjoy my life when I wasn't performing. Jennifer Lawrence, I'm kind of going through a meltdown about being famous. I'm just not going to find peace with it. There's no peace there. Here's a study done in 1997 at Harvard grad students. they asked the students, they said, would you rather make $50K a year or $25K a year? That's option one. Or you could make 100 grand a year, but everyone else makes $250,000 a year. So you see the trade-off? In the first, I make half as much, but I make twice as much as everyone else. In the second, I make twice as much, but less than the other people. The overwhelming majority of these business students chose option number one. They'd rather have less money as long as they're making more than the rest of us. Everything here, what this means is, if you're living your life for money to bring you happiness, it's never going to satiate your soul. It's always going to be a comparison. There's always going to be somebody with more. You could be making $10 million a year, and there's somebody making 11, and you're not going to be happy about it. What about the Barcelona Olympics in 1992? This one is just funny. They compared faces of Olympic medalists, you know, gold, silver, and bronze. And this team asked these undergraduates, they said, in these pictures, who do you think is happier, gold, silver, and bronze? And let me just show you some of the pictures. Gold, definitely happier. Silver, dude, she looks like she just wants to claw someone around the neck. She looks evil. Bronze, kind of happy. I mean, not like ecstatic happy, but I'd say kind of happy. Gold, bronze, and silver. Gold, I might actually put bronze above gold. She's showing both sets of teeth. And silver just looks like, oh, I can't wait to get off this platform. I hate both of you women. This one here, gold, silver, and bronze. Gold, real happy. Silver, that guy has that smile I had at picture day in second grade that, you know. But look at bronze, though. He's just like, oh, I'm glad to be here, guys. And that's really what they found. They found that silver medalists had a 4.8 out of 10 compared to bronze, who had a 7 out of 10. Why? Because it's all perspective. That's why. When you're a gold medalist, you're gold. You're the best. So you're real happy. The silver medalist is thinking to themselves, if I had just trained a little harder, if I had just pushed a little bit harder, I could have been the best. But what is the bronze's comparison? It's not to gold. It's not to silver. It's, I'm not one of the losers who's number 4 and below. I'm up on the podium. This is amazing. This is awesome. And so bronze people are really happy about that. Just really happy when they compare their lives to what they could have been. Well, as we look at this, let's just close up. We look at these pictures and we say, oh, these poor, pathetic, ancient people living 100 years ago. Don't they know that they're killing themselves? Let's ask that question again. Is it possible that we believe in culturally accepted myths that are killing us? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Quite a bit, in fact. The question is, what's the solution? You could identify the problem, but what are you going to do about it? Well, I'd like to suggest that what all of these are really showing is that we have a hunger, a thirst in our hearts and our souls for two things, for love and for significance. We want to be loved and accepted for all of our foibles and faults and fallibility. And we also want to be found significant, that what we do really matters. And what we are really striving for, what we really want, is for this to be real. We don't want it to be some kind of a virtual reality fantasy. We want it to be in reality, truth. And we want it to be unchanging, because if you put all of your happiness into something that changes, once it changes, then you change. You can't do anything other. If my happiness is tied up with the stock market, with my appearance, with my romantic relationship, if that's tied up there, then basically I'm handing over the keys of my life to that and hoping that that doesn't go off the cliff. Because if it does, I'm going to go with it. We don't want it based on comparison. We've seen how that sickens us, that starves us out, comparing ourselves to other people. We don't want it based on performance, on how well I'm doing recently, and how well I look compared to other people. We want it to grow with time. We don't want it just to be a spike of dopamine, and then we're right back where we were, looking ourselves in the mirror. We want it to grow with time, and over and over and over, with time, it gets even better and better. What are we looking for? I'd like to submit to you that you're looking for Jesus Christ. That's what you're looking for. Jesus Christ said, my purpose is to give them a rich and a satisfying life. This doesn't mean that Jesus wants to make you healthy and wealthy and happy all the time. That's not what he's saying. But what is it saying? It's saying that Jesus wants to come into your life. In John 15, Jesus said, I want to put my joy in their hearts so that their joy, their happiness would be complete. I made the decision to come to meet Jesus at the age of 20. It was November of 2004. And I had this realization where I would wake up every day with that sick feeling in my stomach. Why am I here? Why does this matter? What's going to matter in 100 years? I'll be nothing but space dust, worm food. That's it. And realizing I need something else, something that is transcendent. And the good news is God is real. This is not some kind of a fantasy that we just choose to believe, but he wants to come into your life here tonight. And what I won't guarantee is that if you invite Jesus into your life tonight and ask for him to forgive your sins, I will not guarantee that that's going to make you super happy. I do guarantee that something is going to change in your life. For me, I just had that sense of peace. Like that big decision hanging over my head, like a big bill almost, you know, like that was hanging over my head for so long. And then all of a sudden, whew, it's gone. It's been paid for. It's done. And it was at that point that God came into my life and started working with me. And he can do the same thing for you if you just receive him. And this isn't anything spooky or anything weird. It's just asking Jesus, if you died for me, I want you to come into my life and I want to get that relationship started. And if you do that, this will be the best night of your entire life.